Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 13th of August 2017. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Julie Raby and Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Goer. We're now going to talk about Girl from the North Country, which is a musical, or a play with music, I suppose, written and directed by Conor McPherson. What Conor McPherson has done is written a play set in 1934 in Duluth, which is on the Great Lakes, up in, I think, Minnesota. And he has written a story. It's set some years before, about 6 years before the birth of Bob Dylan. But he has incorporated Bob Dylan's songs. Now, there are basically two schools of thought with jukebox musicals. Either you try to fit a story around the songs and try to make them all make sense, or you do a biography where, as you're telling the story of the band, you also tell it through the songs that they are writing at the time. This is something like Sunny Day, the Kinks musical, is that kind of musical. And the first kind probably is the Queen musical, We Will Rock You, which tries very hard to fit some kind of story around the songs. This is somewhat different. What he's basically done is given you a mood. None of the songs are really suited to the characters. In fact, what basically happens is you'll get one or two people starting to sing a song and then everybody else will join in, or somebody else will join in, or they'll take over the song completely. But they're often mood pieces. And what he's done is taken songs from all over Bob Dylan's back catalogue. I mean, we're going back to early 60s numbers, right through, I think, into the 1990s. But it's done with period-appropriate instruments. So guitar, violin, I think there's a harmonium in there, and drums. So we're really appropriate to the 1930s. Style of music. So you have it's a kind of folksy country 1930s style. So the songs sound musically similar, and although Bob Dylan has been all over the map in his style of music, the way that the songs are portrayed here is very uniform and probably very effective. The cast includes Sheila Atim, Ron Cook, Bronagh Gallagher, Shirley Henderson, Kieran Hines, Claudia Jolly, Arinze Kenye, Debbie Currup, Jim Norton, Gene Lane, Sam Reed, Michael Schaefer, Jack Shalhoub, and Stanley Townsend. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, let's talk about the shoehorn first of all. This is in no way a musical, and anybody that calls it a jukebox musical will get a slap from me. This is, as you say, a play with music. And what he's done is he's placed songs by Bob Dylan into a story that's set, as you say, in Dylan's hometown 7 years before he was born. But we're in the middle of the Great Depression here. And the title, of course, comes from Dylan's version of Scarborough Fair. So the North Country is Duluth, Minnesota, not our North Country. Nick, the central character, runs a boarding house. So this is centered around this boarding house. Nick is up to his eyeballs in debt. His wife, Elizabeth, has very early onset dementia. And his son, Gene, is an unemployed wannabe writer with a bit of a drink problem. He's got an adopted daughter, Marianne, who actually was a black baby who was abandoned at the boarding house. And then they sort of took her in, as it were, and she's pregnant. And all of the guests in the boarding house are down on their luck. So we've got a widow, Mrs. Nielsen, played by Debbie Currup, waiting for her inheritance. She's having a panic while she waits, which even Elizabeth in her dementia realizes. And then we've got the Burke family, Mr. and Mrs. Burke and their son. Sounds like something from that I got. I'm sorry, I haven't got a clue. Mr. and Mrs. Burke and their son Elias, they are waiting for money that they're owed. Their son Elias has got very severe learning difficulties. These people have been here a while, but then we have arriving a Bible seller called Reverend Marlowe with a boxer called Joe Scott, which I think they've arrived together, but I don't think they are together, as it were. And they just turn up late one night. But they might not be who they say they are. But Joe does take a shine to Nick's daughter, Marianne. But Nick has other plans for Marianne. And it's co-written by a character that's played by Ron Cook. I actually thought it was just great storytelling. You know, that's what Conor McPherson does. That's what we expect of him. And that's what he does really well here. And somehow, and don't ask me how, you know, these songs, which are written between 30 and 60 years later, just fit the time, the place, the characters like a glove. although they're not necessarily moving the narrative, which is why it isn't a musical in that sense. Macpherson directs, which is often, I think, a bit risky, because I think a greater tension between a writer and a director can be a very healthy thing. But actually, I thought his direction was impeccable. That's unusual in my experience of writer-directors. I think one of the stars of the show are the arrangements and the orchestrations by Simon Hale, because they kind of breathe new life into songs. As you say, the entertainment comes very much over the period, so there's bits of folk and jazz, and so they do feel very different, but they are the same songs. And I thought they were just sensational, really. And the band, the four-piece band, the vocals are really outstanding from people who are not musical theatre people, especially Shirley Henderson, whose voice is just sensational. And the band seem to kind of wrap around these vocals. They know they never drown them out. They're always kind of sensitive to the vocal and accompanying the vocal, which I thought was just outstanding, really. And Ray Smith, as you know, the design reminded me, well, the whole thing reminded me a bit of Once, the musical Once. Simple but atmospheric. But here we've got some particular good use of photographic panels, which kind of come and go, which kind of helps set the scene, really. It was just such a terrific ensemble, and I'm often in awe of acting talent, and here I was being in awe of acting talent again, really. I'm very fond of Arsene Kane, and I've seen him a few times recently, and I was looking forward to him in this, but he was indisposed yesterday. And his understudy, Carl Queensborough, was really terrific as Joe, the boxer who arrives and has a bit of a shine on Marianne. I thought he was just fantastic. Karen Hines got such presence. He's a big man. He's got such presence. And of course, Shirley Henderson is just tiny, so he just towers over her. And at one point, he sort of picks her up. And you kind of see the relative size of the two of them. And Shirley Henderson was just, I mean, just a revelation for me. I mean, she's playing this woman with dementia in such an unpredictable and edgy way. And then she starts singing, and it's just absolutely heavenly. Sam Reed, the son Gene, I thought he was great. And he comes into his own when he's singing I Want You, which I thought he did really, really well. Sheila Atim, we've seen a few times recently, you know, again in fine voice, very, very good as Marianne. And the Burkes, quite important characters, really. Stanley Townsend, Bronagh Gallagher, and Jack Shalhoub were just great as a sort of whole family of itinerant characters. Probably the most experienced musical theatre performer here is Debbie Currup, who I last saw in A Pato in Hackney and in the lead role in Anything Goes. But she doesn't fall into the musical theatre traps. She just sings Dylan's songs beautifully, and she acts extremely well as well. So lovely to see her doing that. You know, for me, it's a play with music. It's his own thing. I think it is actually rather unique. I loved it. And that was only yesterday when I saw it. And I'm now sort of thinking, well, am I going to fit in my second visit then? Because that's how I felt about it. I just felt it was something I want to see even more of.
I have to say that I was not going to see this when I initially saw it until I saw the casting. And basically, you know, if you put in people like Ron Cook and Kieran Hines and Stanley Townsend into a play, I'm going to watch it. And of course, Jim Norton. I mean, who'd miss that, especially when they're doing Conor McPherson's work? I mean, they are people who've worked with him before. And I simply could not miss this, although I was a bit hesitant. And I'm very, very glad I went because, you know, I own a few Bob Dylan albums and I listen to them occasionally and I like his work, so it really wasn't any reason for me not to go, but it was just me thinking, oh yeah, it's a musical, I'm probably not going to enjoy musicals that much, that made me not want to go. But I was incredibly impressed by this. It's a very cleverly woven story. They put the songs in. I mean, the only song I really knew well is Like a Rolling Stone, which is delivered by Shirley Henderson, and it was amazing, really, the power that she was able to put into that song. You can hear one or two of the songs if you've got SoundCloud. You can follow the links from the Old Vic website, and it would be very well worth doing that, although there are only four of them, and often they're done as medleys so that you get a couple of songs meshed together. And that's a very clever piece by the musical director here, Simon Hale, and he's done an extremely good job with this, as you say, keeping the sound together. It is extremely impressive. Sheila Atim was a face I knew, but hadn't seen her sing before, but she was a very impressive singer when she got up there. I mean, I was not surprised that Debbie Currup was so good. I think for me, the only slight note that didn't quite work was when Mr. and Mrs. Burke started singing. Although Bronagh Gallagher had sung a few songs before, and you could hear that her voice was good, it suddenly seemed to go a little bit off key. But then I recognised the song they were singing, and actually they were probably singing the same notes that Bob Dylan sung. and it's Bob Dylan that was off key, not them. Or it's slightly, you know, strange musical choice in that. But even that, I didn't mind that at all. I thought it's just very well done, and it's a very good story that Conor McPherson has done. And yes, the music accompanies it wonderfully, and it's a very, very well worth seeing, I think.
As we left the theatre, we were all saying to each other, there were four of us, we're all saying to each other, is there a cast album? Can we buy the cast album? Because I just wanted to hear it again, really. We all did. But it was interesting that the four of us came from a different angle to the show. I'm actually not a Dylan fan. I came a bit late to Dylan. So I've kind of got some greatest hit stuff and, you know, that kind of early period. But I haven't really been. Another person who was with me is a huge Dylan fan, has got almost every album. There was another person who didn't really know Dylan at all, and another one who was a bit like me, really. And what was great about it is all four of us felt exactly the same about the show. So, you know, you don't have to be a Dylan fan to go and see this. This is just fantastic storytelling and brilliant music. And when you look in the programme, it's hard to see if Shirley Henderson has ever done any singing on stage before. And I thought, for somebody who's 50 now, how have you kept that voice to yourself for so long? Because it is absolutely sensational. So anyway, I think we're all thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up, aren't we?
We're now going to talk about Much Ado About Nothing at the Globe Theatre. This is directed by Matthew Dunster and designed by Anna Fleisch, with a cast that includes Matthew Needham as Benedict, Beatrice Romilly as Beatrice, Anya Chalotra as Hero, Marcello Cruz as Claudio, Stephen John Shepherd as Don Pedro, Joe Dockery as Juana, who is the female version of Don John, Martin Marquez as Leonardo, together with Doreen Blackstock, Lucy Brandon, Ashley Campbell, Oliver Kubil, Charlie DeMello, Amara Nuaz, Sarah Sagari, and Ewan Wadrop. Matthew Dunster is a very interesting director of Shakespeare, I think. His version of Cymbeline, called Imogen last year, was probably one of the hits of last year's main productions at the Globe, I think. And that was a very much changed play. And he's a very interesting director. Now, he has, of course, very publicly sided with Emma Rice. So there is always a possibility that although he is an associate director at the Globe, he might not do much of the Globe when Michel Terry takes over, but hopefully they will click and he'll still work there, because I think his work is extremely good, and I think this is a rather good production of this particular play, and it's done rather well. He set it in revolutionary Mexico, so we're talking about turn of the 20th century Mexico. People like Pancho Villa and, what is it, General Porfirio Diaz, I think is another name to conjure with. At the back of the stage, we have a railway car, a sort of American-Mexican railway car, which is used both as an entrance and exit in the building, but also in the gulling scenes where Beatrice and Benedict are fooled into falling in love with each other. They are used to hide and emerge. The only problem with this, of course, is that the rail car is very flat, and that means that if you're not sitting in the right place, and I think we'll get to this in other people's reviews, you don't see enough of these people or this production, and you miss out on jokes, and you hear people from across the theatre laughing at something and you're wondering quite what they laughed at because you missed that bit. Even if you're standing at the corner of the stage, you might miss bits of this play. So it is a little bit static and it isn't really thought out for the Globe properly enough or well enough, I think, and that's a slight problem here. As with Imogen, but not quite so much, Matthew Dunster has played around with the text a little. We get some fairly realistic reactions to one or two lines, so you will get the odd bit of fairly modern language and often sweary language interspersed in some of the more well-known lines. I didn't think any of that didn't work. I thought that it did work quite well and it felt a lot more natural and much better reaction. And you got some really clever putting together. The major change he has done is that he has made the character of Dogberry into a man with two names, Dogberry, and he is an American filmmaker who's sort of a hanger-on of Don Pedro, and he's making silent films. And in fact, the whole scene where the conspirators are caught is caught here on silent film, and then they have to subtitle the silent film, and that's how you do the questioning. So it was a rather clever piece, and it was entertaining in its own way, and often the Dogberry bits, if you don't get them right, they can be a bit long and boring and drawn out, and I think they did it rather efficiently here and it worked rather well. But unfortunately, whenever you go around changing a lot in the text, you end up with a lot of sort of cod Shakespeare. The central performances of Matthew Needham and Beatrice Romilly, I thought, were very good and very believable. Matthew Needham, who I don't think I knew a couple of years ago, but he really seems to have become quite a dependable presence at the Globe, and it's always interesting to see him. I thought this was very well done. I think it's the best of the plays they've done at the Globe this year so far, as his previous one was. He does know how to make the plays interesting and fun, and the setting, it doesn't get in the way of it. I think you do need, though, it is a play that sort of responds well to a Mediterranean setting, a Latin setting, where you have these very heightened emotions. I mean, it is supposed to be set in Sicily, and it's a play that responds quite well if you put it in that, the southern Italian, or indeed the Spanish tradition, where everybody is sort of very hot and angry, and it works particularly well in that environment, and I think it works pretty well here. What did you think about it, Julie?
Well, I agree with quite a lot of what you've said, and it's interesting for me because I was right at the end in the lower gallery, and I couldn't see very much, to be honest. I felt really I needed to go and see it again because, as you said, it was played out front. There were some moments in the audience, in the groundlings, that I could see quite well, but the railway carriage really blocked the view, and all I could see was when characters came up to the side where I was sat. However, the benefit for me was that I really had to listen very hard. And I think what I found was the cuts quite jarring, because you're expecting a word. An example, Benedict talks in his soliloquy about the paper bullets of the brain, and they cut the word paper. And that really jarred on me, because that's quite important as this kind of surreal image of the bullets in his brain. There was other things that, like Dogberry, it was a bit like Lost in Translation. Instead of the malapropisms, it was mistranslating that was bringing the comedy. And that jarred a little bit as well. And he had a phrase, I think that went well. So listening and not seeing as much as I liked, it did kind of knock me a bit. And I think if you had those visual images to back up what they were saying, it would have probably worked a lot better in that way. And there is a danger when you're moving it out of the original and you're changing words, like the words for the money and the places, etc., that you are consistent. So really modern references, like to healthy eating at one point, Benedict tries to find a rhyme and he comes up with healthy eating. So you've got these kind of three layers that go always mesh together. But there were some really good things. I thought the gender swaps worked quite well, especially Don John as a woman. I thought that worked particularly well in a modern setting. It made sense. I thought that was played really well. I wasn't so sure about the Antonio, but it was nice to see Dorian Blackstock on that stage. Also, I think some of the language was kind of omitted to put in more of the visual. So we had Beatrice ringing the bell when she was asked to bring Benedict in for dinner. And so some of that speech was cut halfway through the line, actually. And you got this clanging of the bell, which sometimes I thought those jokes were just overdone a bit. The horses as well, that worked in parts and didn't in others. I think, you know, the men coming back from war is kind of a move from a serious moment to a comic moment. And I think that was too comic. But the thing that stand out for me was Matthew Needham. And I agree. And I think because he's a very tall actor, he really kind of plays with that. And I think he was perfectly cast for Benedict. I thought he was fantastic in that. And it's really nice to see him doing different things. He was at the Royal Shakespeare Company for a couple of years. And then he took over Henry Percy in the King and Country cycle at the Barbican. So he's played a lot of roles. So he's proved himself in these plays. And it was just fantastic to see him take the lead. And I think he just grabbed it. I thought it was really, really good. There was little things like Margaret didn't quite work for me. I think she's got to be a little bit more like Hero for that to work. But there was that sense again of her realizing her role in the Gullen. So yeah, I actually thought, and I'd seen Twelfth Night in the same week, that what was going on here was an attempt to put on a Shakespeare on a sunny afternoon on the South Bank of London, kind of make references that an audience, the groundlings, would get, and really think about what original practice was, which was a great afternoon out seeing something you hadn't seen before. And rather than just kind of trying to recreate the language of the Little Reading Period, I think what this production and the Twelfth Night was doing was to try and recreate the whole sense of what it was to go to the Globe and have fun and enjoy references that you recognised. And I think both the productions together have worked brilliantly, and it will be interesting to see what Michelle Terry does, because I think as an actress, she's really innovative, and I can't see her wanting to go back to that original practice kind of twee way of doing Shakespeare that actually isn't original practice. I'm thinking of the As You Like It, was it Blanche McIntyre, a couple of years ago, which was fairly traditional, but Michelle Terry as Rosalind, she put a little bit extra into that portrayal, and I think that's what she'll do. She'll be true to the text in many ways, but she'll give them a real contemporary feel. And I do think this season has been much better than last season at the Globe. I don't know what you think, Alice.
Oh, yes, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you say. I think the Much Ado is a real crowd pleaser, and I think it was squarely aimed at that, as you've indicated. I was lucky enough to be a groundling, but right in the middle of the stage, so I could see everything that happened in the widescreen staging. But I can appreciate that those who were round a corner, or round the, what could call it, the corner of the round of the Globe, maybe had then restricted view. I felt it was very much an ensemble piece. Matthew Needham, as you said, he did make a marvellous hangdog Benedick, but altogether it did feel like a piece which everybody was contributing and enjoying themselves. And apart from the times when, of course, you had the tragedy, and of course, the actors then did convey the more tragic elements. But altogether, I felt it was the ensemble that came across. It's not the greatest Much Ado that I've ever seen, but it was very, very enjoyable, you know, full of sombreros and ponchos and Once Upon a Time in the West cigarillos. And I think the Mexican background did work very well, because at the time it was about civil war in Mexico. So you had Don Pedro, who was very well played by Steve John Shepherd, as slightly insecure in his position as well. And of course, he had a sister rather than a brother, Juana. And in this chauvinistic atmosphere, Joe Dockery was very convincing, and you could see why she might be resentful of the way her whole position within this Mexican household and the male machismo surrounding her. I actually thought Leonardo, Martin Marquez, who is Hero's father, was extremely good. I was very taken with his performance. He was very tough, but obviously at the same time he had this same idea of machismo and family honor, and then became slightly vulnerable as well. One of the outstanding parts for it actually was the music. I think the composer was James Maloney, and there was a Mexican band with a guitar and trumpet, and it was very good at actually not just being background music, but actually delineating the scene changes, especially in a partial open air theatre like the Globe. where you're more or less using the same scenery all the time, it not only conjured up this dusty and, you know, very vibrant Mexico, but it did signal the mood of the oncoming scene as well in the action. And they were very fluid and very clear scene changes for the audience. All in all, I think it did work. I wasn't that keen on Dogberry, although comic scenes in Shakespeare, yeah, they are sometimes do feel a bit clunky, but I did feel that the whole business with the filmmaking and the revelation that revealed the dastardly doings that had been going on film, I felt that took away a bit from what had happened with Hero and Claudio. It took away from the visceral feel because it did put it as well at one remove, and you were watching this film. And I wasn't convinced by that, although interestingly, I did find out with a bit of background research that there was a filmmaker with Pancho Villa. So it actually worked logically because they were doing newsreels. But I wasn't entirely convinced by that. But all in all, I think the audience went out very, very happy. They'd caught on to the story. It was clearly done. There were some outstanding performances, although it was more of an ensemble piece, I felt. And yes, with my unimpeded view, I did enjoy it.
We're now going to talk about Catherine Hopton Roof, the play by Tennessee Williams, and it's at the Apollo Theatre. This production is being done under the aegis of the Young Vic, who are basically putting this on. It's directed by Benedict Andrews, who is a director they have discovered and quite like using at the Young Vic. He very famously did a rather strange Three Sisters, which was very impressive. Lots of moving furniture around. And oddly enough, it worked particularly well, I thought, and although it did divide some people. This is a much more starry West End approach to the play. The headliners here are Sienna Miller as Maggie the Cat and Jack O'Connell as Brick, with Colm Meaney as Big Daddy. And we also have Brian Gleeson, Richard Hansel, Lisa Palfrey, Michael J. Shannon and Hayley Squires. The play is set on a steamy night in Mississippi. The family gather at a plantation for Big Daddy's birthday. But the play takes place in the bedroom of Maggie and Brick, as they try to put their marriage back together, I suppose, and confront some of the things that might have broken it down. Tell me more about this production, what you thought of it, Julie.
Well, I really enjoyed this production, and I think I did like the fact it was in the Apollo with the Christine Arch. It was kind of a grand scale. I think that really worked. I did like the pace of it. The only thing that's kind of frustrating are intervals in these West End theatres when it really takes people ages to get in and out of the seats, and it is really disrupting, and then getting everybody back and you kind of lose the momentum. And here there was a sharp break as well as the interval. So it was really enjoyable in terms of the setting, and it was a kind of modern setting as well. And I think that worked really, really well. I had a lot of reviews around the nudity, and there is quite a lot of nudity. Straight from the start, you see Jack O'Connell naked in the shower. And I do think to some extent that nudity did work quite well, particularly in terms of the Brit character and that idea of masculinity exposed and being broken down. I don't think it worked so well for Maggie. There's a moment where there's some nudity with her character. And I think it didn't work so well because when she dresses and undresses, that is really interesting, the way she plays these different roles. And I think what I really liked about the production, it really gave a sense of the heat of the situation and things getting really hot emotionally, as well as the tension and the heat and the outside, but also the way that the layers start peeling off. So the greed of the family and all the dysfunctional relationships that are going on. not just Maggie and Brick, but the two brothers falling out, Big Mama and Big Daddy. They actually, their relationship isn't as it seems, holding this family together. And it's all peeling back. And then at the end, you're hearing the cries and the screams of the ill father. And that's really brings it home as this kind of real tragedy of this family that actually could have had everything, but it's just totally can't be mended. It can't be put together. So I thought there were some really good performances. I liked Sienna Miller's performance. I really liked Jack O'Connell's performance and Colmeany and the rest of the cast. I thought they were all really good. And I just felt that maybe not so much nudity in terms of the female nudity because it didn't have the same impact. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
I thought this was a decent production of it. It is very modern. I mean, we have a black set and the shower goes onto what looks like a very, very plush carpet. Obviously, there's some kind of drainage going on, but there's very little actual scenery. We have a large golden backdrop and this very sort of black carpeted set with just a bed and a dressing table, and that's about it. The thing about this is that I remember, I think Benedict Andrews, the last couple of things I've seen him direct, he's been using Vanessa Kirby, and I couldn't help thinking that he would have worked with Vanessa Kirby than with Sienna Miller. I think Sienna Miller was perfectly good, but I don't know, it's a big monologue, basically the first act of this play, and you really need a great actress to really make this a really great piece. And she's a very good actress, but she's not a great actress. And I think that I did get that slight feeling that you can sell the seats with Sienna Miller. You may not be able to sell the seats with Vanessa Kirby, but you should have had Vanessa Kirby doing this because it would have been electrifying. So it wasn't quite as electrifying as it could have been. The thing about Jack O'Connell, I mean, again, a very good actor, but yeah, I wanted more subtlety. I wanted more from him than just a drunken, tattooed who of course looks rather good because he's very well put together. But I didn't need all that from him. I wanted a little bit more. I mean, I've seen Adrian Lester play this part. I've seen Brendan Fraser play this part, and of course Paul Newman playing this part in the film. And there is something really special about those actors that wasn't quite there with Jack O'Connell. And it's not really a criticism of either of them because they were very good. But you could just see that they might have been excellent somewhere else and might have been excellent if they obviously decided to take the risk and put it on in the West End and put it on with sort of names that people would recognise rather than names that people wouldn't. And if they put this on at the Young Vic, they probably wouldn't have used all the same actors. But it was well put together. I mean, Colmeany is always a great person to see on stage, and he's an actor that you admire a lot, even going back all the way from the stuff he's done with Roddy Doyle and also all the Star Trek stuff he did in the 80s and 90s. So he's always an impressive presence in anything. So it was a great treat, and we had some very nice performances from Big Mama and the Lasky Wife, which is Lisa Palfrey and Hayley Squires, really giving good support. So yeah, it's a good production, I think, and I hope get people interested in the play because it's always a play worth seeing. But this could have been a great production rather than a good production with other people. But, you know, it's what sells in the West End, I think, that is what may have affected the decisions. There was just that slight feeling. And I think it's a slight feeling because I can reel off these names. I think if you don't know all the different people, all the different possibilities that there could be in casting, then perhaps you wouldn't feel that it's lacking anything. I think you would find it perfectly acceptable and be perfectly happy with the play. So I think it is something to be highly recommended for people to go and see and just to find out about it. It's an interesting way of approaching the play, and I thought well done all round.
I think for me, being a theatre person and not really seeing a lot of cinema and television, that actually these two actors, obviously extremely well known generally, but not to me. So I have to look them up and find out what they're in. And I do see what you mean about Vanessa Kirby. I kept thinking that all the way through. However, I did like Jack O'Connell because of the things that maybe you didn't like as much. And that rawness of that performance, I just felt really got over that he's kind of just breaking down, and yet he's still the favourite. And, you know, and he didn't seem to have done anything. And I know what you mean about the subtlety, but I just felt that actually this kind of masculine body that just shatters in front of you actually worked really well for me. So that was a positive, I think.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.